A logo appears in bold, slanting letters over a blue planet in space. Turner. Now a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Titles appear in a black and white film. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents Greer Garson as Kay Miniver and Walter Pidgeon as Clem Miniver in Mrs. Miniver. A William Wyler production. Copyright 1942 in USA by Lowe's Incorporated. This film is described for blind and visually impaired audiences by Descriptive Video Service, WGBH Boston. Described by Robin Sitton and Michael Braden. Read by Peter Haydu. Funded by the United States Department of Education. Opening titles continue with Teresa Wright, Dame Mae Whitty, Reginald Owen, Henry Travers, Richard Nye, and Henry Wilcoxon. Produced by Sidney Franklin. Screenplay by Arthur Wimperis, George Freshel, James Hilton, and Claudine West. Based on the book by Jan Struther. Musical score, Herbert Stothart. Directed by William Wyler. Words appear. This story of an average English middle-class family begins with the summer of 1939, when the sun shone down on a happy, careless people who worked and played, reared their children, and tended their gardens in that happy, easygoing England that was so soon to be fighting desperately for her way of life and for life itself. Now, on a busy London street, a double-decker bus rounds a corner and pulls to a stop. A woman rushes down the sidewalk, her arm loaded with shopping bundles. She holds her round, lace-trimmed hat down with her free-gloved hand. She wears a dark suit dress tied at the collar with loops of laces. At the bus doorway, she pauses and glances anxiously behind her.
Are you still, bus?
All right, lady, on or off, please.
A conductor walks between the seats.
That's all, next class.
Yes, please.
Beverly Crescent.
Who?
Beverly Crescent.
Not on this line, lady. Get off next stop. Take number 19.
Yes, please.
I'm sorry, conductor. Would you mind stopping?
What, leaving us already?
Yes, you see, it's in the opposite direction.
That's about the only place we don't go, lady.
Yes, please.
On the sidewalk again, the woman rushes frantically against the flow of pedestrian traffic. She has fair, wavy hair and a tall, curving figure. She holds onto her hat as she pushes through the crowds, then waits impatiently to cross a busy street. As cars speed past, she closes her eyes and mutters to herself. At a break in the traffic, she bustles across, nearly colliding with a bicyclist. She enters a boutique, and two sales ladies exchange a smile.
Why, Mrs. Miniver!
You know,
Mrs. Miniver's face falls.
Don't tell me it's gone.
Just a minute.
As the clerk steps briskly into the back of the shop, Mrs. Miniver clutches her bags and tries to catch her breath. The clerk brings back a round fur hat with a chin scarf. A scissor-tailed bird crowns the center.
Oh, I was so afraid you'd sold it.
No, we knew you'd come back.
I know it's foolish and extravagant. I don't know what my husband will say, but I simply got to have it. Yes, pack it up quickly. Don't give me time to think. I might change my mind.
Oh, careful.
Later, entering a train car, Mrs. Miniver sees a man in a clerical collar.
Hi, Vicar. This is nice.
For me it is. Let me put those on the rack for you.
She grips the hat box.
Oh, no, not this one. I might leave it behind a bit, sir. It's rather precious.
Yes, I know the feeling.
Do you?
Guess what this is?
A wrapped box.
Port.
Worse than that, cigars.
Well, why not? My husband does.
Yes, he can afford it.
Oh, dear, I'm not so sure. He has a very extravagant wife.
Oh, nonsense.
No, it's quite true. I can't help it. I'm afraid I do like nice things. Things far beyond my means sometimes. Oh, pretty clothes and good schools for the children, the car, the garden, you know.
Yes, I know.
Does it give you a lovely, guilty feeling?
Lovely.
They shake hands.
Fellow sinners, dear lady. What will the village say?
Oh, I think the village knows you're a very understanding person. That's why you do so much good.
Well, I hope I do. I hope I can when they need me.
You mean you think there is trouble coming?
A stern face peers in their window.
I think it's here.
Good evening, Lady Belden.
Good evening, Vicar.
A stately woman and her attendant.
Oh, shopping's absolutely impossible nowadays. You can't get near the counter, and when you do, they haven't got it, and you pay twice as much for it.
What a wonderful description.
Sit down, Simmons, and don't sniff. My dear man, I spent the whole afternoon being pushed around by middle-class females buying things they can't possibly afford.
Oh, dear, that means me.
Oh, no, much worse. You're Mrs. Mannering, aren't you?
Miniver.
Oh, yes, yes, of course, the lawyer's wife.
No, my husband's an architect.
Well, I knew he was something of that sort. I don't know what the country's coming to. Everyone trying to be better than their betters. Mink coats and no manners. No wonder German is arming.
Mrs. Miniver and the vicar share a laugh. Later, the train arrives at Belem Station. A white-haired station master stands on the platform and collects tickets from arriving passengers. He tips his hat to Lady Belden, then Mrs. Miniver and the vicar.
Good evening, ma'am.
Good evening,
dearest bag.
Vicar, do go on, please.
Well, goodbye, then.
Goodbye.
Thank you. I was looking for you on the 5 o'clock.
I missed it by 2 minutes, isn't that shame?
Well, time and tide waits for no man, and trains neither. Are you too late, ma'am, to spare me a moment? I got something to show you.
Well, I...
It's something very special.
Well, of course, Mr. Ballard. Do show me.
This way, ma'am.
He leads her into his small office, a cluttered room of wooden file drawers and thick ledger books. Potted plants live on the sunny windowsills. Mr. Ballard hangs up his uniform cap and steps to a fireplace mantel. Leaning his elbow on it, he cocks a knowing grin. With a glance, he directs her attention to a vase containing a full-blossomed rose with glossy leaves.
Oh, Mr. Ballard.
It's my masterpiece.
How lovely.
You like it, ma'am?
I think it's the most beautiful rose I've ever seen. The shape.
And the scent.
She leans her nose into it.
Oh, divine. And the color. I adore red roses.
They said, as Cupid danced among the gods, he down the nectar flung, which on the white rose being shed, made it forever after red.
Oh, where did you find that?
Hutter's seed catalog, ma'am. It's pretty, but it ain't true. What goes to make a rose, ma'am, is breeding and budding and horse manure, if you'll pardon the expression. And that's where you come in, ma'am.
He nods with a deep bow of his head.
I gotta have a name for it.
Oh, you want me to name it for you?
No, ma'am, I got a name for it. If you'll give me your permission.
Why, of course. But I don't see
I want to call it the Mrs. Miniver.
Oh.
If you'll pardon me, ma'am, I've watched you go in and out of town for years now, and you've always had time to stop and have a word with me, and I've always waited for you to come home, and you remind me of the flower. And I think it'd be a very good name for my rose.
It's a lovely compliment, Mr. Ballard. I'd be very happy indeed to have you name your rose after me.
Ah.
Ballard's eyes twinkle under his bushy white brows.
Well, I really must go now. I'm terribly late already. Goodbye, Mr. Ballard. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
I think it's lovely having flowers named after you. Goodbye.
Bye.
Later, a taxicab carries Mrs. Miniver up a hard-packed dirt road between tall white picket fences. As she steps out of the car, she glances at a man in a convertible parked across the road. Another man peeks up from the floor of the front seat and watches her enter an ivy-covered brick home. He smiles sheepishly.
That's my wife.
Oh. The man behind the steering wheel wears a trench coat and fedora. Mr. Miniver gets out of the car and soundly shuts the passenger door.
Good as new, huh?
Well, almost, sir.
It's a sporty, high-polished roadster with a covered spare tire on its running board and double horns mounted beneath the headlamps. Mr. Miniver kicks a tire and walks completely around the long, sleek car. He leans one hand on it and puts the other in his pants pocket.
It's a nice car, but I'm afraid it's a little more than I can afford.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. But we have some nice cars in a cheaper bracket.
But I like this one.
The salesman's forced smile fades, and he looks away.
Well, I'm going to take it.
Perhaps you'd better think it over.
Oh, I'm going to take it. You bring it around tonight after dinner?
Very good, sir.
And whatever you do, don't let my wife know how much it cost.
As Mr. Miniver strides toward his gate with his overcoat on his arm, the salesman drives away. Mr. Miniver has a smile-dimpled face and a long, sloping nose. Tall and square-shouldered, he wears a double-breasted suit and carries a newspaper, umbrella, and blueprints. Inside, a blonde girl practices on a baby grand piano while her teacher looks over her shoulder.
Hello, Judy.
Hello, good evening, Daddy. Good evening. Oh, Mr. Miniver, you're just in time to hear Judy play her piece.
But I'm afraid that...
Oh, please do. It would encourage her so much. Encourage both of us, in fact.
I'm a little late. Next time, perhaps, huh? See you later, Judy.
Bye, Daddy.
A little boy carries a cat downstairs.
What's the hurry, Toby?
I can't stop, Daddy. Napoleon wants to throw up.
Who does he?
Mr. Miniver pauses on his way upstairs and adjusts a grandfather clock to read 6:15. Upstairs, in the master bedroom, Mrs. Miniver talks on the phone.
I wouldn't dare tell you the price, though. It's really too extravagant. I feel terribly guilty about it. But I was already on my way home, and something just seemed to come over me, as if I were in a sort of trance. And I got off the bus, and...
Hello, darling.
Oh, Clem.
How are you?
That's Clem, dear. As I was saying, I got off the bus, and then I suddenly remembered that Vin was due down from Oxford tomorrow. Yes, Vin, dear, tomorrow. Isn't that exciting? And so we're all going down to the station to see him. Isn't that wonderful? Sophie, you idiot. Clem was standing right here beside me. And of course I haven't told him. Well, you don't just throw things like that at a man. Well, there wasn't any connection. I just had to say something.
She hands the hat box to a maid who cleans up the bundles.
Well, I'll probably tell him after dinner tonight. He's usually most docile when he's having his coffee.
Mom, may we go to the station to meet Brother Vin tomorrow?
Of course, darling.
In the nursery.
Is Vin still a vegetarian, Mother?
I doubt it, darling. He'll have some new idea.
That was just a phase he was going through.
What's a phase? Oh, it's just a thing people go through.
Do I go through it?
Oh, yes, you're going through one right now.
Am I?
Mm-hmm. I'm going through a phase.
Stop waving your arms around and finish your supper.
What phase will he be going through this time?
We'll just have to wait and see. Now, okay, me darling, because I mustn't keep Daddy late tonight. Good night, sweetheart. Be a good girl.
After dinner, a maid serves coffee to the Minivers in the dining room.
Could I just run down to the post, ma'am? Cook says she'll clear.
Well, of course, Gladys, but don't let Horace keep you out too late.
Oh, no.
Rather a dashing fellow, young Horace Perkins, eh, Gladys?
Oh, sir.
Gladys leaves them, and Clem walks to a sideboard where he clips the end off a cigar. At the table, Kay fidgets with the silverware, then folds her arms.
You know, Kay, I was thinking... I'm sorry. Go ahead, dear.
No, it wasn't anything. What were you going to say, dear?
Oh, nothing important. I just wondered if you had a nice time in town today. That was all.
Oh, wonderful. I shopped and shopped. Just little things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Clem lights the cigar and puffs on it casually.
Oh, I had a puncture in the car today.
Oh, what a shame.
Tires are getting pretty worn, that old bus.
Clem, you know what I think?
What?
I think you ought to buy yourself a new tire one of these days.
New tire? Yes, it might not be a bad idea, that.
They aren't so frightfully expensive, are they?
Oh, I guess we can swing it, all right.
I mean, a new tire shouldn't cost any more than a new hat, should it?
A hat?
Well, I just said hat. I might have said shoes or trousers or anything. Some more coffee, dear?
Oh, I have some, thank you, darling. Yeah, that old bus, pretty sad. Been giving a lot of trouble lately.
Has it? I hadn't noticed it.
Of course you hadn't. That's the danger with an old car. You don't notice anything wrong, and then one day when you're doing about 70 miles an hour,
Not with our car, dear.
And that's another thing. It's too slow. That car is dangerously slow.
Clem, what have you been up to?
Smiling, he grabs her hand.
Come on, get your coat and hat on. I got something to show you.
Later, they barrel down the street in the convertible. As they take a sharp turn, Kay flies into Clem's shoulder.
Smooth, isn't she? You all right, darling?
Later, at home.
I was afraid you'd think I'd been a bit too extravagant.
Kay stands between their twin beds.
Oh, all of us are extravagant now and then, don't you think?
Of course, it's fun. What's the use of having a little money if once in a while you just can't be, well, reckless with it? Throw it away on something you really want, huh?
Kay smiles and heads for a dressing room alcove near the bathroom.
Where are you going? Oh. After all, what is money? It's a token. It's the power to buy ourselves something that'll make us a little happier. You shouldn't be a slave to it, though. Say, what are you doing anyway?
She peeks out, wearing the new bird hat with her floor-length nightgown. The scarf hangs down her left cheek to her waist. Clem, in monogrammed pajamas, sits up in his bed, open-mouthed.
What on earth is that?
You like it?
You?
I bought it today. Isn't it lovely?
Not bad.
I do think it does something for me, don't you?
Yes, it makes you look rather ridiculous, I think.
Oh, Clem.
Well, maybe it's this gown. It doesn't quite go with it.
Yes, but just look at the hat itself. And of course, when I've had my hair done to look different.
She drapes the scarf different ways, under her chin and over her shoulder. Clem narrows his dark eyes.
Yes, it's very pretty.
Good. Then I think it was worth the money.
Oh. Much?
Not too much for people with a car like ours.
You're pretty clever, aren't you?
I hope you think so, darling.
Kay, sit down here a minute. Let me look at you. You're really quite a beautiful woman, aren't you?
If you think so, darling.
I think you're even more beautiful than when I married you. Could that be?
I don't see why not. I've had more reason to be.
She leans forward and kisses him.
Put that silly thing away and get into bed.
She sets it on the bedpost and admires it.
Come on, don't stand looking at it all night.
He shuts off the lights.
In you go there.
It's been a lovely day all round, hasn't it?
Yes.
Kay takes off her slippers and settles into her bed.
Clem, I think we're very lucky people.
Because we've got a new car and a new hat.
Oh, much more than that. Because of Vin and Toby and Judy. And each other.
Yeah.
She lies back on her soft pillows.
Clem?
Huh?
Guess what?
Huh?
I had a rose named after me today.
You left the light on in the dressing room tonight.
Kay holds up her nightgown hem and scurries to the alcove. She switches off the light, then hurries back to bed and pulls the blanket to her chin.
Good night, Clem.
Good night, dear.
Propping herself up on her pillows, Kay admires the new hat displayed on the post of her bed. The following day at Bellum Station, the Miniver family waits on the platform. Kay holds Toby's hand firmly as he hops up and down excitedly.
There he is.
There he is.
A young man with a pipe hugs Kay.
Hello, Mother.
Ben.
Ben,
darling.
How are you, boy? Fine to have you back.
Judy. Hello, Toby. Toby.
Ben's got a pipe.
Well,
Ben's
what of it, young fellow?
Oh, heavens, you've grown.
Oh, only about half an inch, Mother.
I've grown a young.
Have you, Toby?
Where's the moustache you used to have, son?
You used to be so proud of it.
Well, I don't remember being so very proud.
Oh, I liked it, Ben.
Oh, sorry, Mother, but, well, my plan took up too much of my time.
Oh, it did?
Yes, keeping it trimmed and all that sort of thing, you know. Well, after all, one can't waste too much time over the vanities of life.
I see. Well, come along, children. We better get along.
Yes. Let's go. Here we go.
K Kay marvels at her grown son in his suit and derby hat. In the car, Vin sits in back with her.
So your interest doesn't center in cars anymore, eh, Vin?
Well, you see, Dad, this last year at Oxford, I've rather changed my whole outlook on things.
You don't say.
Yes, I think I've grown a little. Matured in my conception as to what life's about.
Ah.
Do you know what Oxford has really taught me, Mother?
What, dear?
It's taught me that I know absolutely nothing about anything.
Rather a waste of time and money, then, isn't it?
Oh, not at all, because it's shown me clearly just what I want out of life.
And what's that, Vin?
To learn. I want to encompass all the knowledge I can in my brief span.
What span, Vin? It's a bridge.
A bridge?
When I think of the vast amount of knowledge there is in the world, scientific knowledge, philosophical, sociological, and when I realize the infinitesimal part of all this knowledge I possess, well, it actually makes me shudder. And apart from all that, Mother, I think I've developed a social consciousness.
Later at tea.
What's that, Vin?
Why, it's the recognition of my fellow man.
Oh.
Where are there free men today any more than there were in the 9th and 15th centuries?
Front door, Gladys.
The maid scurries
the
away.
The 15th centuries, I say, when the lords held all the land and passed out what they wished to their vassals. Well, look about you. What have we? As pure a feudalistic state as there ever was in the 9th and the 15th centuries. I tell you, when I think about it, I'm appalled, genuinely appalled. I tell you, Father, when I think of the class system that exists in this country to... What is it, Gladys?
Oh, it's Miss Belden to see you, Ma. Where'd you hurry in, Gladys? Miss Belden. Oh, I wonder what that means.
Oh, she's probably brought the latest ultimatum from her illustrious grandmother.
Well, I scarcely know Lady Belden.
Mother, there you have the perfect example of what I've been saying. Lady Belden's the living proof of the survival of the feudal system today. You can't escape from the pernicious Belden influence. It contaminates the entire fabric of village society.
Just as in the 9th to the 15th century.
Exactly.
Gladys shows in a young woman.
How do you do, Mrs. Miniver? I'm Carol Belden.
How do you do, Miss Belden? This is my husband.
How do you do?
And my son, Vincent.
How do you do?
You're just in time for tea, Miss Belden.
Yes.
Well, thanks so much, but I've just had some.
Well, sit down anyway.
Oh, I can only stay a moment. Please do sit down.
The men take their seats.
You really must excuse me for invading your house like this, but frankly, I've come to make a request. A personal request, and as a great favor.
Well, please sit down.
Well, thank you. You see, my grandmother doesn't know I've come. I'm afraid I'm not very good at breaking things gently, so I'll get straight to the point. It's about the rose.
The rose?
Yes, the one Mr. Ballard grew, the Mrs. Miniver. You see, I hear that he's going to enter it in the flower show.
You mean for the Belden Challenge Cup?
Yes.
But no one ever has entered,
no one has ever entered a rose in competition my grandmother before. And that's just the point. It's become a tradition for her to win the cup, and her roses mean so much to her. I know it seems an awful thing to ask, but I thought you might, perhaps, as a favor, persuade Mr. Ballard to withdraw his rose from the competition. You see, to be frank, it's such a beautiful rose, it might easily win, and... Well,
Miss Belden, may I ask whether this is an open competition?
Yes, technically.
Technically, yes, but actually, no.
Yes, I suppose that's it, you see.
Oh, I see only too well, Miss Belden. Because Mr. Ballard is not of the ruling class, is a mere vassal, as it were.
Now, Vin, please, let Miss Belden explain.
But, Mother, Miss Belden doesn't have to explain, not to me. I'm aware of the influence of the feudal system in this village. These are orders from the manor. Her ladyship must be offered no competition.
Miss Belden, you must excuse my son. He's just down from Oxford.
Oh, don't apologize for me. I mean everything I say.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. But do you do anything about it?
Do? I don't... What do you mean?
If you feel something is wrong, what are you doing about it? I've spent most of my holidays these last few years doing settlement work in the slums of London.
Oh, you wallow in luxury all the year.
I don't wallow.
And think a few weeks playing the Lady Bountiful.
Shh, Bindi.
Come, Vin.
Well, it's not much, perhaps, but it's the only thing I know. What have you been doing?
I
see. Just talk. Well, that's all right. It's easy.
Listen, I didn't say anything
about... Don't apologize. I know how comfortable it is to curl up with a nice fat book. Full of big words and think you're going to solve all the problems of the universe. But you're not, you know. A bit of action is required now and then.
Action? Well, if that's what you and your class are asking for, maybe you'll get it one of these days.
Maybe, but not from the talkers.
Ben. Remember, Miss Belden is a guest here now. If you have any manners at all...
Manners are everything, aren't they? A humble working man is denied the reward of his artistry to gratify the overweening vanity of an aristocrat.
Be quiet, Ben. This is no concern of yours.
I beg to differ, Father. I'm concerned for a fellow man, for his dignity, and the indignity that's heaped upon him. You'll excuse me, I'm sure, Miss Belden.
Certainly.
Vin storms away from the terrace.
I must apologize for Vin. Oh, no, please, it's all right. And besides, he's rather nice, isn't he?
What? Oh,
well, really, you know, he's perfectly right. I've absolutely not a leg to stand on in this business. I shouldn't have asked you. I realize that before the words are out of my mouth. It's just that my grandmother's over 80, and she takes such a pride in winning year after year.
Of course.
Oh, but please forget I said anything about it. Anyhow, I'm glad we met at last.
So am I. I hope we'll see more of each other.
I hope so, too. You'll be at the sailing club dance tonight, won't you?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Good.
Now in a village shop with a grocer and his customer.
Yeah, people talk, you'd think Mr. Ballard had committed a crime.
I don't go with people getting ideas above their station. Who's Mr. Ballard to think he can enter his rose in the flower show?
And who's to say he can't, Mrs. Huggins?
Nobody's ever entered a rose in the flower show against Lady Belden since she started 30 years ago, and I thank you to keep a civil tongue in your head, Mr. Foley, or I'll be doing my shopping in Medicam after this.
My opinion has got nothing to do with the quality of my merchandise, Mrs. Huggins.
Now in a bell tower.
If you called your rose the Lady Belden, I'd have said quite right and proper. But who's Mrs. Miniver?
The nicest lady in the neighborhood, Mr. Huggins, that's who.
Yeah, maybe, but a newcomer.
No, no, Mr. Ballard. You stick to the railway and leave roses alone.
Why should I, eh? Why should I? They're my hobby, the roses are, and the railway can go to...
Ballard slips and sways from a rope. That night, at the sailing club dance, Carol Belden dances with a young man. From a nearby table of guests, the Minivers watch her sweep past.
Doesn't she look lovely?
And a sense of humor, too. I love the way she handled in this afternoon.
I think she's coming over.
The gentlemen rise.
Hello.
Good evening, Miss Belden.
Hello.
Please do sit down. I just want to say hello.
Well, sit down,
ma'am.
Thank you.
Enjoying it?
Yes, it's your wonderful band.
How about a cordial?
No, thanks.
Cigarette?
No, thanks. I was rather looking for your son.
Oh, I'm sorry, Vin's not here.
No, he's suffering from an acute case of maturity.
Yes, but it'll pass. We give it a week or two at the outside.
I wanted to tell him I was sorry about this afternoon.
Oh, I rather think he wanted to say the same thing himself.
A waiter.
I beg pardon. You, Miss Belden.
He brings a note.
May I?
Of course.
Certainly.
The note reads, "May I see you for a moment alone? I am waiting on the old boat landing. Vincent Miniver."
Secret?
Can I suppose it is.
Do I scent romance?
Well, it is intriguing. Will you excuse me?
Of course.
Please don't get up. I'll see you later.
Is it that big Navy lad from Darton?
You'd be surprised.
Outside on the landing, Carol spots Vin staring out at the water. He folds his arms over his tuxedo jacket and poses one foot on a piling. Carol holds back a smile, then approaches with deliberately heavy steps. Vin turns his tanned, narrow face toward her.
Hello.
Hello.
He walks stiffly toward her, wringing his hands nervously at his sides.
You got my note?
As you see.
Yes, of course. Miss Belden, I don't want you to think I'm going back on anything I said this afternoon.
Oh, of course not.
But I did express myself a bit emphatically. I hope you'll excuse me. My mode of expression, I mean.
But there's really nothing to excuse. Everyone's entitled to his mode of expression.
Still, I'd no right to lose my temper. I'm usually quite detached.
Well, I was pretty snippy myself, wasn't I? And quite in the wrong, anyway. I'm sorry.
It's nice of you to say so.
A toothy grin sweeps over him.
Well,
Carol's wavy brown hair frames her smooth face.
I suppose I'd better be getting back. I promised this tango.
Oh, you couldn't. Well, I mean, just for a moment. You see, I've got so much I want to say. Well, to explain about myself. Of course, you want to dance.
You don't dance?
Oh, yes. Yes, I do. Matter of fact, I'm considered a pretty good dancer. But I've rather given up that sort of thing.
Oh?
Well, I mean, frankly,
Is this a time for frivolity?
He props up his foot again.
Is this a time to lose one's sense of humor?
She smiles wryly, and Vin's forehead wrinkles. He looks away, his full lower lip poking forward thoughtfully. He glances back, and Carol smiles wider. Vin plants his feet on the floor and coolly rolls his shoulders. On the dance floor, they waltz gracefully through the crowd, staring into each other's eyes. Carol stands chin high to Vin. She tilts her slender neck to gaze at him. Vin guides them swiftly around the floor, never taking his eyes off Carol. They wheel past his parents, who look on them with wide-eyed surprise.
Did you say give him a week or two?
Maybe an hour or two would be enough.
Later, Carol, in a sparkling taffeta gown, strolls with Vin to an outside patio.
And I used to see you go by. And you used to ride a little tub cart, and then you had a pony.
Oh, yes, he was a dear. Oh,
he was very, very fat, and so were you.
I was not fat.
You were very fat. Why, you had legs like overstuffed sausages. You see, I've really known you for years and years. I used to think about you a lot.
She blinks and shakes her head.
Well, don't you believe me?
Well, you know, you are a good talker.
Oh, I wish I were. I'd like to tell you just how I feel.
You've told me quite a lot for one day.
One day? Why, one day's ridiculous. What's one day out of all the vast... Do you have any con...
She smirks at him and blinks.
Oh. Can't we arrange to meet again sometime soon? Tomorrow.
Tomorrow I'm leaving for Scotland.
Oh, for long?
Till the middle of September. We always go every year.
But that's months. Well, may I write to you?
Yes, Finn.
Oh, I say, this has been a wonderful evening, hasn't it?
Yes, Finn.
Back inside, the young couple dances closely together.
It's been a wonderful evening, hasn't it? Oh, I said that before.
It's been a wonderful evening.
For you too?
Me too, Vin.
The club members stand at reverent attention facing the band. At the Miniver's table, Kay sneaks a look behind her husband at Vin and Carol across the room. The youngsters smile pleasantly at each other. Later, in the village church, Ballard and Huggins ring the tower bells. Huggins strains against a heavy rope.
We'd had all that quarreling for nothing. Don't look as if there'll be a flower show after all.
Why, what makes you say that?
Well, her ladyship's talking of postponing the show on account of conditions.
Very right and proper. They marched into Poland, haven't they? That means war, if you ask me. And if war comes, it's goodbye roses.
Don't talk silly. You might as well say goodbye England. There'll always be roses.
Mr. Ballard takes his hat from a banister post carved with a man's face. Now, in the church sanctuary, stone carvings of armored knights mark the tombs of village ancestors. The Minivers take their seats. Kay kneels in the pew and covers her face. She pushes Toby down on his knees, but his head soon pops up over the bench again. Lady Belden and Carol process up the aisle with two servants behind them. The ladies enter a pew separated from the others by a door marked with a brass plaque. A chauffeur covers Lady Belden's lap with a velvet blanket. As the ladies lower their heads in prayer, the chauffeur and a woman attendant take their seats in the rear of the church. Boys' choir in black and white robes walks ahead of the vicar. In the congregation, Vin reaches over his sister Judy's shoulder and helps her find a page in her hymnal. Spotting Carol across the aisle, Vin leans forward, crushing Toby against the pew. The small boy punches Vin with his tiny fist until Kay quiets him. She follows Vin's gaze and smiles.
She's
just come back. She wasn't to have returned for another week.
He catches Carol's eye, and she brightens. He grins back, and his mother pushes the hymnal closer to his face. Carol watches him through her hat's netted veil, while Lady Belden faces forward blankly.
Dearly beloved brethren, the scripture moveth us in sundry places to acknowledge and confess our
A church warden strides up the aisle carrying a staff in his hand. He whispers in the vicar's ear as the congregation stands in the pews. The vicar turns and looks out over the 50-some waiting faces. Kay and Clem exchange a tense look. Gravely, the vicar steps up to the raised pulpit.
Will everyone please be seated?
The congregation sits. Then they lift their faces to the vicar standing above them.
It has just been announced over the air by the Prime Minister that our country is at war.
Vin and Carol exchange an anxious glance.
In the circumstances, I don't think you'll wish me to continue with this service, as you'll probably, most of you, have some other duty to perform. I will say simply this, that the prayer for peace still lives in our hearts, coupled now with the prayer for our beloved country. We in this village have not failed in the past. Our forefathers for 1,000 years have fought for the freedom that we now enjoy and that we must now defend again. With God's help and their example, we cannot and shall not fail.
A woman in front of the Minivers breaks down in tears. Kay stops singing and pets Toby's head. As the woman's husband comforts her, Clem reaches for Kay's hand. The vicar steps down. While the congregation leaves the sanctuary, Toby turns to his father.
Are we going to be bombed, Daddy?
Shh, Toby, don't shout, darling.
Are we going to be bombed?
Lady Belden hesitates at the church doorway.
Carol?
I'll be right along, Granny.
I beg your pardon. Carol.
Hello.
Oh, you came back early.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so glad. Oh, how are you fixed in case of anything?
Quite all right, I think. I must go, Vin. Goodbye.
Yes?
Huh? Kay takes her older son's elbow, her younger son's hand, and files out of the church. As the Minivers arrive home, the younger children chatter happily on their way up the front walk. Vin broods behind the others. Inside, their cook races out of the dining room.
Oh, my mom's glad to come. That Gladys, she's carrying on, pardon me, sir, carrying on something awful. I've practically had her on the ends all morning.
Oh, Ada, what's the matter? What's happening?
It's on account of Horace, mum. Called up and asked to join his regiment tonight.
No.
Yes, mum. And Gladys in floods of tears.
Oh, dear.
And that's told. The man only come Friday to look at it, and what he done, I don't know. But she's not fit to wait, mum. She's not really.
Well, never mind, Ada. Just say we'll manage somehow.
Napoleon!
Toby, take him away. Well, Ada, I suppose they broadcast the news.
Yes, Mum. What a dreadful thing. And that laundry. It's lost another of my best aprons. But we've always got the Navy.
Later at dinner, Gladys the maid serves plates of food as Clem fills them with pie. Her plain face tightens against her tears. Toby grins over his shoulder at her. Gladys takes another plate from the head of the table.
Oh, come on now. Cheer up, Gladys. I don't suppose Horace will be anywhere near the front line.
Oh, yes, he will, sir. He's always been one to push himself forward. He says, you let me get me hands on Hitler. I'll give him sweat sticker, he says.
Give him what?
Sweat sticker. You know, sir, the sign what they have on their flags.
She makes a crooked
cross. Oh, well, that's the proper spirit, Gladys.
He's got too much spirit. He gives way to it. I beg pardon, Mum, but would you tell Gladys that Horace has got to catch his train, and he says, could he come in a minute and say goodbye?
Oh, of course he can.
Come in, Horace.
Thank you, sir. Morning, Mum. Morning, everybody.
Well,
good morning, Horace.
Will you have a sherry?
Don't mind if I do.
Help yourself.
Oh, yes.
And jolly good luck to you, Horace.
Yes, indeed, Horace.
Yes, brother.
Jolly good luck, Horace.
Thanks, Master Toby. Your very good health. My best respects, Mum.
Thank you, Horace. The children are going to miss you terribly. And poor Gladys.
Oh, she'll be all right, Mum, won't you, Glad?
She falls on Horace's bearish chest and throws her arms around his neck. He steadies his cordial glass.
Here, here. That's not the way to behave.
How do you expect me to behave when you leave me and go off and get killed?
Well, cheer up. I ain't killed yet. Here, have a drop of this. You don't mind, sir?
Oh, sir.
No, go on, Gladys.
Gladys drains the sherry, then smiles giddily.
There, that's better. Have one for yourself now, Horace.
Thank you.
You'll want Gladys to see you to the station, won't you?
Oh, thank you, Mum.
We'll go and get your hat. Go on.
Oh. Very nice drop of stuff, this. Last I shall get for a bit, I expect. Yeah, make a lot of difference to a lot of people, this war will.
Yes, a lot of difference.
We may all meet in the front line yet.
Not me, Horace. The RAF for me.
Oh, boy.
I've always been keen on flying.
Yes, Kay throws right. Vin a frosty stare across the table.
I'll say goodbye, Mum.
Yes, of course, Horace. Goodbye and the very best of luck.
Thank you, Mum.
Goodbye, Horace. You let us know how things are going.
Right? I will, sir, but you'll have to excuse the spelling. I'm better with a bayonet than what I am with a pencil, I am.
You can write it in blood.
A nice child you have.
Gladys returns in gloves and hat.
Hello! Well, she's done you proud, Horace.
Not off, she ain't. Full dress inspection kit.
And very nice too, Gladys.
Thank you, Mom.
Say goodbye to Napoleon.
Goodbye all, and Cat. And many thanks, I'm sure.
Goodbye, Horace. Goodbye, Horace.
As they exit, Gladys pulls the kitchen door shut with her foot.
Goodbye, Horace. Goodbye, Horace.
Mind if I get on with the blackout, Mother?
All right, dear.
Thought I'd run up to the Belden place later on.
Oh.
Two women alone, you know, might be a good idea to look things over.
Yes, I think you should, dear.
Times like these one ought to be neighborly, don't you think?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed, one should.
Can I go with you, Mother?
If you have you.
No!
Judy tromps back to the table, her head lowered and her arms hanging at her sides. She plops into her seat and fingers her fork. Kay toys with her food and stares blankly at the flower centerpiece in front of her. One thin eyebrow arches tightly against her temple.
Isn't he very young, even for the Air Force?
Yes, he's young.
Clem stares at the table and absently rubs crumbs from his fingertips. Kay lifts a bite to her mouth and tries to chew it. Vin runs up the steps of a manor house.
May I see Miss Carroll?
Is she expecting you, sir?
No, but, well, I think she would see me.
Vin!
Hello, Carroll.
Oh, it's all right, Chandler. It's nice of you to come.
Well, I wanted to find out how you were getting along, if everything's all right.
Oh, do come in. Everything's fine. After a terrific row with Mr. Foley, my grandmother's at last agreed to obey the blackout regulations.
Good, I was worried about you.
That's sweet of you, Vin. And it was sweet of you to write those letters to me while I was in Scotland.
So you did get them?
Yes, of course.
Well, I wondered if you did when you didn't answer.
Vin, I didn't know how to answer. You're such a crazy boy, and I didn't think the craze would last.
Craze?
Well, it is rather sudden, isn't it? This is only the third time we've met.
Well, does that matter?
No, but I like to be sure. I don't really know you very well, do I?
We could do something about that. We could see a lot of each other. Every day while I'm around. Would that be all right?
Why, yes. Why not?
Oh, gosh, I'm glad to see you again.
I'm glad too, Vin.
I say, is it an awful nerve? Well, I mean, we have a sort of agreement, haven't we? Would it be going too far?
It's all right, Vin.
She tilts her chin and they kiss quickly. Lady Belden enters.
I heard voices. May I ask whom you're entertaining?
This is Vincent Miniver, my grandmother.
How do you do, Lady Belden?
Miniver, eh? Miniver. I know that name.
A rose with that name's been entered in the flower show.
Now, Granny.
The Miniver Rose. That's something new. The Marshal Neal. The Frau Koldrischke. The Duchess of Argyll. And now, the Mrs. Miniver.
Please, Granny.
A tramp rose grown in a station yard.
It's nothing to do with Vin.
Then what's he doing here, if one may ask?
Oh, I came to offer my services.
I see. You're in league with that wretched Foley, I suppose.
Oh, no, Lady
Bellamy. A-R-P-O-A-B-C or X-Y-Z or some silly tummy rot. We can take care of ourselves. We've been doing it for the last 800 years.
But Lady Bellamy,
We don't take orders, we give them. The worst thing about this war is the chance it gives these dreadful little persons to make themselves important. Air raids, indeed. Those wretched Germans, they wouldn't dare.
The stout Lady Belden squares her shoulders. She stands beside an ornate mantelpiece, wearing a high-collared Victorian-style gown and back-swept hairstyle.
What should we do?
Do? Nothing. Probably Foley giving a false alarm.
No, Lady Belden, you can't take that attitude.
I beg your pardon, young man.
There may be danger, and you must take precautions. Ring for the butler and ask him to gather the servants together in the cellar. And then go down there yourself. Quickly.
Aye?
I must call my parents. Where's the telephone?
It's in the hall.
Well, upon my word.
The butler.
Sirens, milady.
I'm not deaf. Get all the servants quickly into the cellar.
You too, Granny. He said so.
Lady Belden glares at Carol.
The cellar.
Hello? That you, Dad? All right with you?
His eyes follow Carol.
Yes, everything under control.
Right, I'll expect you when I see you then. Who is it?
Harry Gordon.
Hello, Foley, what's up?
You're showing a light.
We are.
The grocer in badge and helmet.
Bright horizontal beam, plainly visible from the air.
But every window in the house is...
Ground level.
Ground level. Oh, gosh. This way, Foley.
At the bottom of the cellar stairs, Kay and Gladys huddle with the children beneath a work lamp.
Good evening, Miss Miniver.
Good evening, Mr. Foley.
Foley points to a stack of crates piled loosely against a basement window.
How about this blanket, Mr. Foley?
I think I can use it all right.
He straightens the top crate against the window, then drapes the blanket over them.
There. That fixes that. It's those tiny cracks that do the damage. One man lighting a cigarette on the road stands out like a beacon from 5,000 feet up.
Yeah.
One little crack of light might lead the old German Air Force straight to this house.
Well, it was lucky it was just you, Mr. Foley.
Yes, indeed, ma'am. Strictly speaking, you're liable to a fine of 40 shillings. But a senior warden, I think I can promise you, you'll hear no more about it.
Oh, that's awfully nice for you.
You've got a nice place here for storage. Hear the Minister of Food on the air the other day? He recommended stocking up a bit. You want to put in some tin foods, case of emergency. Sugar now. Sure to go up. I've got some wonderful demerara at £2-3. How much we say? £50 be enough?
Well, really, I don't...
Make it 20, then. £20, best demerara. Do you like Bismarck Eric?
I hate them.
Kipper snack, salmon, sardines. I've got some lovely Italian sardines. Might not be able to get them later. You never know what that Mussolini's going to do.
Gladys pulls her crocheted shawl around her maid's uniform and looks from Kay to Clem.
All clear.
Guess they couldn't have got much further than the coast, right?
Is the war over, Mummy?
No, darling. This is just the first day.
Oh, good.
Oh, God.
Attention, England. This is your English friend in Germany again. Now listen carefully while there's yet time.
In a local pub, a radio plays on the bar counter.
It's now 8 months since your government declared war. 8 months of progressive disaster for the enemies of the German Reich. France has been utterly defeated, as I told you she would be, if you remember, and her invincible armies completely crushed. I need hardly tell you that England comes next on the list. Already the boasted British coolness has given place to blind panic. Already there have been serious riots in your key industries. And they didn't tell you that, did they? Already the British lion is howling with terror.
A man pops up from behind the radio.
From the highest to the lowest, from peer to peasant.
Turn it off,
in a mad rush for
the
safety.
Well, he's all wind and whitewash like a blinking rook. Can't we get some news?
Not till nine. Yeah, you work over at Eyfield. Did you see that German plane come down?
No, I heard it. I wonder where the pilot got to.
No, no, there's a lot of cover in them quarry woods. You could lay there for days.
Ah, but he's got to get food, don't forget. It'd be funny if he's to walk in here, wouldn't it?
The bartender shakes his head.
He'd never do that.
I don't know so much. They're clever, you know. Some of them, they goes to Oxford, and they learns to speak English just as good as what you and me do.
No.
Well, almost. Hey. Huh.
The pub's blackout curtain opens, and Clem Miniver enters, leading a group of armed villagers.
Did you get that, Fritz?
Not yet, but we will. Need a double whiskey.
Yes, sir.
What are you fellas having?
Same thing.
I'll have a beer, sir.
Vin enters in a uniform and trench coat.
This chap was a nice too, wasn't he?
Got six of our fellows.
Vin slaps his dad's shoulder.
Cheerio!
Vin!
Hello, Dad.
Where did you spring from?
Bellum Airfield. I've been transferred.
Bellum? Well, you're practically on the doorstep.
Yes, isn't it grand? I was just buzzing home and I saw you come in.
Oh, this is good news.
Oh, you don't know the half of it. See that? Pilot Officer Miniver.
A wing patch on his uniform.
Soon? I thought...
Well, you know, things are moving pretty fast out there, and they cut short the course.
Uh-huh.
Say, I got 85% in the test and a week's leave on the strength of it, Dad.
Uh-huh. Well done, Mr. Thanks.
Congratulations, sir.
Great stuff. Congratulations. That calls for a drink. Set him up, George.
Yes, sir.
What'd you have, Ben?
Oh, I don't think I will, thanks. It's a bit late, and I phoned Mother I was coming. I called Carol, too.
Yeah, I'll bet you did.
I thought I'd run up there later on.
How much do I owe you, George?
5 and 6, Ben.
5 and 6. There you are. Keep the change. Let you
thank you. Thank you very much.
The old villagers raise their drinks. Later, Clem and Vin arrive at home. Vin sets down his bag and unbuttons his rain-soaked trench coat.
Where's everybody? Kay!
Kay and Carol appear together at the top of the stairs as Vin pulls off his coat.
Well, what is this?
Vin!
As he dashes upstairs, his side cap flies off.
Darling.
He pauses, then hugs Kay.
Carol, both of you, it's wonderful.
Carol kisses his lips.
I didn't want to miss a minute of you, Vin. How are you?
Well, fine. Don't I look it?
Oh, isn't he brown?
Open air life, Mother. Oh, gosh, it's good to see you all again. I sort of don't know which way to turn.
He points to his wing patch.
Oh, seen these, by the way?
Makes a good-looking pilot, doesn't he, huh?
Oh, Vin, already?
Yes, and 2 months before my regular time. Not bad, eh?
And what a bit of luck being transferred to an airfield so near.
Say, a fellow I knew at the last airfield had his people living round about. And whenever he flew over them, he used to cut his engine so they'd know who it was, you know, like this.
He puts his arms around both women.
Well, I suppose now you're ready for real flying.
Oh, not only for real flying, but real... Well, whatever they send me into.
Fighting.
At the bottom of the stairs, he embraces Kay warmly.
Say, where are the kids?
Upstairs, just starting the dinner.
Oh, you wouldn't weaken and let them have dinner with us.
Oh, I think I might.
Wait, I'll run up and tell them.
No, I'm going.
She slips past Vin.
Hey, I'm coming.
Yeah, I've got change.
He grins at Carol as he passes up the stairs. Stooping, he flips the soft military cap behind him over the railing, and Vin catches it. Alone with Carol, Vin gazes awestruck at her.
Hello.
Hello.
He takes her in his arms and tenderly kisses her. Later, Gladys serves the family dessert.
Have you heard that we're losing Gladys tomorrow, Ben?
Oh, is Horace on leave?
Oh, no, sir. Gladys has joined the WEFs. She's off to Aldershot.
What's a WEF?
Women's Auxiliary Air Force.
Of course, it's just a coincidence that Horace is stationed at Aldershot, too.
Oh, sir. You're out of love.
Mother.
Yes, darling.
Is Vin going to marry Carol?
Now, Toby, just finish your dumpling, darling.
I only said is Vin going to marry
Toby.
Carol.
It'd be nice having Vin at home, sweet, and staying down here for dinner with us.
Yes. Are you going to marry Carol, Vin?
Well, since you bring it up, Toby, I haven't had the nerve to ask her.
Why not? You're brave, aren't you?
Don't be so silly, Toby. Those men don't propose when they're eating. Why not? Well, it's not romantic.
Clem tweaks Judy's nose.
Of course it isn't.
Carol looks wistfully across the table.
Toby?
What?
Why don't you ask me if I'm going to marry Vin?
Are you?
Vin sits back.
If he asks me.
Huh, he's afraid.
Why, say, I'm not going to stand for that. Carol, I meant to wait for Judy's romantic moments and all that, but will you marry me, Carol, soon? Oh, ye gods, this is the darndest proposal I have. Is it yes, Carol?
It's yes, Vin.
They kiss, and the children stare in shocked delight.
Hooray!
Toby bangs the silverware and rings the servant's bell.
Dear, I'm so happy. Oh, I'm so terribly younger.
I'm going, Vin. May I go ahead, Dad?
Clem kisses Carol's cheek, while Kay clasps the girl's hands in hers.
It's the telephone, ma'am. He says he wants to speak to Pilot Officer Vincent Miniver.
Kay's smile falls as Vin answers the phone. He stands easily, still grinning, with one hand in his pocket.
Hello. Yes. You're speaking. Yes.
Suddenly, he comes to attention.
Why, of course, sir. Oh, I see. About half an hour. Yes, sir. Immediately, sir. Goodbye.
He returns to the dining room, where Kay sits with her arm around Carol.
That was the airfield. I had to report at once.
Oh, no, Vin.
It's a blow, isn't it? They certainly picked their moment.
Oh, but why?
Oh, some job or other. You don't ask why in the Air Force. I'm sorry, Mother.
I can't believe it, Vin. They promised you a week.
You know how things are. A good job I hadn't unpacked. I'll go up and get my bag. I promised to be at the airport in half an hour.
I'll get the car. Drive you over, Vin.
Oh, thanks, Dad.
Kay, Carol, and Clem watch as Vin dashes upstairs, two steps at a time.
Well, it's a disappointment. No use pretending it isn't. But now that we've got him so near...
Does that mean that he's going into action?
Not necessarily, Carol.
He glances over Carol's head at his wife. His hands stir restlessly in his pockets.
Well, I better get Carol.
As he gathers his hat and coat from the front entrance, Kay slips her hand around the back of Carol's chair. Clem leaves through the front door, and the women remain in the dining room. They wait and watch the stairs. Carol's young, round face furrows with worry. Kay holds her jaw tense and her eyes unblinking. Vin trots downstairs in his hat and coat, with bag in hand. They rush toward him.
Well, it certainly hasn't been much of a leave, has it? Goodbye, Mother.
Goodbye, darling.
They kiss.
Well, do take care of yourself.
Oh, I will.
He turns to Carol.
Goodbye, you.
Carol grips him by the shoulders and kisses him. Kay watches their farewell with a bittersweet smile.
Be good. Remember, you're engaged. I say you'd better not tell the old lady. Not until I get back. Then we'll go hand in hand and beard the old line in her own rose garden.
Teary-eyed, Carol smiles.
Goodbye, Judy.
Daddy, some souvenirs.
Well, what do you want?
Mashersmith.
Toby points his fingers like guns. Then he races after Vin.
Vin!
Yeah?
Make me 8 eyes, Father.
All right.
The boy holds out his arms like wings. Vin flies him in loops and spins, and sets him back down on the floor.
Bye. All right, I will. Goodbye, and don't worry about me. 85% of the test, you know.
Bye, darling.
Later, in their bedroom, Clem leaves the dressing room as Kay turns down her bed. He smokes as he walks toward the window's heavy blackout curtains.
Hey.
Oh.
She turns off a bedside lamp, and Clem opens the curtains.
What a beautiful night. Clear as day.
He takes off his robe as she climbs under her covers.
Happy about the engagement, Clem?
Oh, very. Sweet child, young Carol.
Isn't she?
Wonder how the old lady's going to take it.
She'd be proud.
You, couldn't be prejudiced, could you?
Certainly not. Vin's a very unusual boy.
Yes.
In the dim light, they lie wakefully on their backs with their hands over their chests. Kay lifts her eyes to the ceiling and listens. Kay's eyebrows arch attentively. Her eyes flit across the ceiling.
Listen, Clem.
Huh? Engine trouble.
No, it's Vin.
Vin?
Yes. Don't you remember what he told us about signaling? About the boy who used to signal to his mother. It was Vin.
By Jove, I believe you're right.
Through the bedroom window, they see a squadron of five planes flying in a V formation.
Good old Finn.
Good luck, Finn.
She lifts her hands to hold Clem's, gripped around her shoulders. Later that night, a breeze wafts through their open windows and gently stirs the ruffled curtains. Kay and Clem sleep soundly in their beds. Kay stirs.
Hello?
Clem.
She bolts upright as Clem lifts the phone receiver.
Yes? Who? Oh, emergency, I see.
What is it, Clem? What is it?
It's all right, dear.
Is it Finn?
Oh, no, it's only the river patrol. Right, old man. I'll come right over.
You're not going out on the river tonight.
Oh, I've got to, darling. I'm on patrol.
He picks up his watch.
I wonder what's up. 2:30.
Oh, what on earth can they want?
They care about you.
You've been out after that German flyer all day, and I'll not let you go.
Now I am confused. Are those orders?
Kay gets out of bed.
Where are you off to?
Sandwiches and thermos. If you're going on duty, you'll need them.
Clem rises stiffly and lumbers to the dressing room. Later, at the sailing club landing, a man waves Clem's boat, Starling, to shore and moors it. Clem hops quickly onto the pier where other patrolmen secure their boats.
Thank you. Hello, Miniver.
Hello, Halliday. Harvey, what's on? Do you know?
I don't know, sir.
He's your crew. How much petrol have you got?
About half full.
Why, what's up? Fill her up, Dixon.
Inside the ballroom, the patrolmen, dressed in civilian clothes, crowd around a bar.
Hello, Mr. Miniver.
Wish I knew.
What do you make of it?
I don't know. You know, Joe?
All I know is I've been dragged out of my bed to open up the bar.
The blackout curtains ripple.
A couple of points to starboard there.
A man staggers out in a tuxedo and top hat.
Scotch my hay where Wallace bled. Hello, chaps.
Why the glad ray?
Well, I was in London at the Savoy, and I got old Hallandy's call to come on, and I come straight on down.
Ah, oh, good man. Any idea what we're up to?
Who cares? There's not a reason why. There's but to do or die. Gallons, 600. Give me a drink.
I say, Miniver, what do you make of it? I'm willing to do anything for the good of the country, but this business of digging us out at 2 a.m.
Yes, I think that's carrying the war a bit too far.
Where are we going, Halliday?
My orders are to collect all the petrol boats of 30 feet and over that I can lay my hands on. Shove crews in them, fill them up, and send them over to Ramsgate.
Ramsgate?
Why Ramsgate?
I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. The sooner we get off, the better.
Where? Hooray for Ramsgate!
Clem gulps his drink.
Sign that for me, will you, Joe?
Sure, thanks.
Mac takes a bottle from the bar.
Come on, Mac.
Sign that for me. We're 100 pipers and all, 100 pipers and all, 100 pipers.
On the river, pleasure boats and fishing trawlers creep through the dark along a narrow waterway. In Clem's large launch, his shipmate shrugs himself into a leather jacket. In another boat, a craggy-faced skipper and his pilot watch the route ahead. They pass private landings where wooden punts bob beside an open boat shed. Across the river, high grass and shade trees conceal a country home. Farther downriver, the fleet grows larger. As small boats wend through the English countryside, they pass hamlets and churches on the distant hills. Cruising beneath a stone bridge, the flotilla, 50 or so strong, stretches from bank to bank, churning up tiny white caps in the calm water. Their silhouettes outline an assortment of vessels, high-masted fishing boats, wide flatboats close to the water, and long cabin cruisers. As they enter a riverfront town, another fleet appears on an adjacent branch of the river, and they merge. The giant fleet now slows to a halt, each boat no more than an arm's length from the one beside it. As Clem eases the Starling into Ramsgate Harbor, he marvels at the collection of ready boats packed in tightly around him.
Close to 1,000.
The bow of a naval destroyer plows through the harbor.
Attention, please! Attention, everyone! Attention, please! Switch off your engines!
Clem stills his motor. He leans forward on the boat's windshield and watches the ship turn broadside.
As you know, the British Expeditionary Force is trapped between the enemy and the sea. 400,000 men are crowded on the beaches, under bombardment from artillery and planes. Their only chance to escape annihilation rests with you. Your destination is Dunkirk. It's my duty to tell you that the effort is not without risk. You're asked to cross 40 miles of open sea, many of you in small boats that are far from seaworthy. Shore guns and enemy aircraft are going to make it hot for you. Any of you who wish to withdraw may do so now.
Mac, still in his top hat, laughs. Other skippers stand firm.
Very good. We'll put to sea at once. Smaller boats without compasses will endeavor to follow in the wake of larger ships at the head of the line. Every moment counts. Good luck to you.
The boatmen stare stone-faced as the destroyer pulls away out of the harbor and into the black night. Clem turns to his one-man crew.
All right with you, Nobby?
Aye, sir.
Turn him over.
In his trench coat and fedora, Clem steadies himself against the ship's wheel. Other skippers around them gather their lines and start their engines. In the crowded harbor, larger boats with smokestacks stay close to shore, while smaller vessels form themselves into broad rows. A towered suspension bridge spans the river above them. In the pre-dawn darkness, the town remains blacked out. The volunteer fleet streams out of Ramsgate Harbor for the open sea. At home, Kay comes down the shadowy stairs. Wearing a fitted coat, she pauses on the landing and advances the grandfather clock several minutes to read 6:30. She continues downstairs and strides into the sitting room. Morning sunlight brightens the landing as she opens the blackout curtains. Later, she wanders outside, following a garden path along a stone wall. Beyond the low wall, the river sparkles in the sun. Pausing at the end of the path, Kay closes a gate and squints upriver under her hand. Mr. Ballard comes along, carrying fishing gear.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning, Mr. Ballard.
You're up early?
Yes, I haven't been sleeping very well.
She looks up.
Listen. Guns.
Ballard steps past the dock.
Ah, funny how the sound carries with this east wind. Mr. Miniver's not back from Dunkirk, I suppose.
No, he's not back. Neither is my son. They've been gone 5 days now.
Oh, they'll be back, ma'am. You'll see.
Yes. I'll be very glad to see.
You will. Them that goes down to the sea in ships and has their business in the great waters, these men see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the great deep. You can't beat the Bible, can you, when it comes to deep feelings?
No.
No, and no one that's thrown that over for a set of gobbles and gorins is going to win this war. That's my comfort, ma'am.
Mine too, Mr. Ballard.
There's to be a flower show this year, you know, up at Belton Hall. It takes more than a war to stop her old ladyship.
I'm so sorry. What were you saying?
I was telling you about my rose, ma'am. I've entered it for the show. And I should know better than to be bothering you.
Oh, but you're not. I'm so glad. It's a beautiful rose. It deserves a prize.
Thank you, ma'am. Well, I'll be getting along.
Good day, Mr. Ballard.
The old man tips his cap and continues along the riverbank. Kay watches him go, then strolls back toward the house, twirling a twig in her hand. She stops and stares. Among the sun-dappled bushes lie the muddy legs of a man. Kay frowns and peers closer. Young and unshaven, a uniformed soldier lies on his stomach in the underbrush, eyes closed and taking shallow breaths. A Luger pistol lies by the German's limp left hand. Kay carefully approaches him. She kneels. With her gaze fixed on the pistol, she reaches for it with a trembling hand. The soldier's eyes open. Kay freezes, gaping. The German slowly slides his hand over the gun and starts to sit up. Kay backs off, then turns and flees. The soldier gets to his feet.
Hey!
He glances around, then chases Kay back through the woods to the house. She bursts in the kitchen door.
Get my body, she said.
She freezes in the doorway. The downed pilot comes in, aiming his gun with his left hand and holding his wounded right arm close to his body.
Move, or make noise. I shoot.
Breathless, Kay glares at him. The lean, sharp-nosed pilot glances out the window from behind the blackout curtain.
Alone.
Kay nods.
My children are upstairs. And the maid, all asleep.
The German gestures with his gun, then grabs the door and swings it closed. He swallows tightly and looks around the kitchen.
Food. Drink.
All right.
Kay walks warily past him to the counter. The German closes the window curtain, then threatens her with his gun.
Food, quick.
All right, I'm getting it, but stop pointing that gun at me. You're frightening me.
She opens a bread box and pulls out the end of a loaf. The German grabs it from her and smells it. Backing away, he puts his gun on the counter and gnaws the bread.
Milk. Milk. Hurry.
His dark circled eyes watch her keenly as she opens the refrigerator. She takes out a bottle of milk and puts it in the German's outstretched right hand. Supporting it with his good hand, he raises the bottle to his lips and drinks deeply. Kay watches him.
Me?
Yes, I think so.
Kay turns back to the refrigerator and rummages.
Hurry.
I am hurrying.
She produces a plate with a block of ham on it.
Go back.
She backs away. The German puts his gun on the table and devours a slice of ham, constantly keeping his eyes on Kay. Listening, the German hides behind the door.
It's the middleman.
He aims his gun at Kay. His uniform soiled with breadcrumbs and milk, he swallows hard and waits. Outside, the milkman puts a case of milk bottles on the stoop and walks away. The German presses himself against the door as the milkman's shadow moves past the kitchen window. He peeks out the curtained window. He totters on his feet. His head bows wearily. The gun droops in his hand. Kay takes a few hesitant steps toward the woozy pilot, but he snaps out of it and levels his gun at her. He looks around.
Coat. Give me coat.
His sunken gaze follows Kay as she walks past.
Wait.
I'll get you the coat.
The pilot urges her with a wave of his gun. As she steps to a connecting door, he jams the gun in her back.
Keep door open. Go.
He watches intently as Kay goes into an adjacent room. She returns with an overcoat of Clem's. The pilot takes it on the end of his gun and backs away from her. The wide-eyed Kay presses against a counter as the German awkwardly puts on the coat. Sliding his good arm into the left sleeve, he hunches and tries to pull the coat over his blood-streaked right arm. He steadies himself against the table, then, with one hand, quickly buttons the coat around him. Thin in Clem's oversized coat, he stuffs the block of ham into a pocket. He picks up his gun and straightens to face Kay. Limping past her, he pauses unsteadily, then lurches to the door. Kay approaches him, her brow knit with concern. The German keeps her at bay with his gun. He looks sharply out the window, searching. With a final warning glance at Kay, he opens the door. His head droops, his gun falls, and he collapses to the floor. Kay stares for a moment, then quickly bends down and takes the gun. She hurries out of the kitchen, through the sitting room, to the telephone at the base of the stairs. She puts the gun next to the phone, then picks up the receiver and dials 0.
The police. Urgent, please.
Her nervous gaze flits around the room as she waits.
Police, this is Mrs. Miniver. Miniver. Starlings. I've got that German flyer, the one who escaped. In the kitchen. Yes, I'm all right. Will you come to the back door? He's wounded. Bring a doctor. Thank you.
Kay puts down the phone. Taking a deep breath, she grips the gun firmly and strides back to the kitchen. She finds the German pilot still slumped unconscious on the floor. She leans carefully over him. His head tosses. His black-booted legs shift. Kay stows the gun in a drawer, then steps closer and bends over him as he starts to wake up. He lifts his head off the floor, but falls back, breathless with the effort. His eyes open. Slowly, their glassy look fades, replaced by a fearful stare. Kay straightens up, her features composed. She watches the German as he feels the floor around him, searching.
I took your gun.
You called police?
Yes. It's much better. Let me help you.
She reaches out. The German slides away from her and slowly gets to his feet. He teeters and clutches his head. Kay grabs him under his arms and helps him to a chair. He lies with his head on the table as Kay opens a curtain to let the sun in. She wets a cloth at the sink and holds it to the German's neck. Gently, she supports his forehead and sits him upright.
Yeah, now it's much better this way. Really, it is. You'll be wonderfully looked after in hospital. You'll be safe there. And the war won't last forever.
He grabs the cloth.
No. Sooner we finish it.
He winces in pain.
I'm finished. But others come. Like me. Thousands. Many thousands. Better. All this. You will see. You will see. We will come. We will bomb your cities. Like Barcelona. Warsaw. Narvik. Rotterdam. Rotterdam we destroy in 2 hours.
And thousands killed. Innocent people.
Not innocent. They were against us.
Women and children.
30,000 in 2 hours. And we will do the same thing here. Even like vernichten alle.
Kay slaps him. Her clenched jaw trembles. They face each other frozen for a moment. Kay goes to the kitchen door and lets in 2 uniformed policemen and a doctor in a black suit.
It's his arm, doctor.
Kay's tense shoulders heave as she composes herself. She gets the German's gun from its hiding place and waits by the door.
All right, sir. Come on in, fella.
She stares into space while the policemen escort the German out. Her gaze unwavering, she hands the gun to one of the officers.
Thank you, ma'am. Move along now.
The doctor pauses in the doorway.
You all right, Mrs. Miniver?
Yes, thank you, doctor.
Doffing his black fedora, he leaves. Kay shuts the door after him and leans against it, her chest heaving with tight, shallow breaths. Clutching her coat around her, she sinks into a chair and wearily leans back her head. She swallows, trying to relax. Little Topi runs in, wearing his pajamas.
Mummy? Who is that, Mummy?
Kay takes him in her arms, her eyes shining with tears as she embraces her young son.
Who was here, Mummy? Who was here?
She clutches him again to her chest and runs her fingers through his thick, tousled hair. Her troubled gaze lifts, and she listens. Kay stands and carries Topi to the window. She opens a shade and stares outside.
Clem! It's Daddy, darling! It's Daddy! Run and tell Judy!
Topi hurries out. Kay runs outside. She reaches the path along the river just as Clem's motorboat rounds a bend into view. Kay runs down the steps to the dock and waves to her approaching husband. Bringing the boat alongside, Clem throws Kay a line and hops onto the dock. They embrace.
Oh, I'm so glad to see you.
Daddy!
Oh,
Daddy!
Hello, darling.
Daddy!
How are you?
Oh. Awful dirty!
And I'm awful tired. Gosh, but I'm tired.
Speak a bit. Are you sure you're all right?
Yes, I'm fine. Just the boat.
His boat has missing panels and a broken windshield.
Come on, children. Go on, Topi. Any word of in?
No. But he'll be back soon, I'm sure of it. Darling, it's so lovely to have you home. Come on, Topi.
Arm in arm, they head back up to the house. Later, in the bedroom, Clem buttons his pajamas while Kay closes the drapes and prepares his bed.
I was asleep for a week. Oh!
He flops onto the bed. Kay draws the sheet over him, then the blanket, and a comforter.
I'll get you some breakfast, darling.
Clem lies still, his eyes closed. Kay smiles and tenderly kisses his cheek. As she draws away from her sleeping husband, her bright gaze drifts to a window. She closes the curtains. The room grows dim. Kay returns to Clem and folds his limp arm over his chest. With a brief smile, she walks around the bed and heads for the door. She stops and turns toward the window, listening, her lips parted and her nostrils tight. With unblinking eyes, Kay inches toward the window. The soft light shades her smooth, high cheekbones and strong chin. Her lips tremble. Her shining gaze lifts. She hurries to the window and opens it. Shadows of warplanes streak across the house. Kay peers up into the sky. She smiles.
It's been, Clem, it's been!
Her husband still sleeps. Her gaze returns to the sky. Kay shuts her eyes and leans her head against the window. Her eyes open again, now shining with tears. She blinks and pulls back into the room. Glancing at Clem with a smile, she swings the window closed and draws the blackout drapes. Later, the bedroom now deeper in shadow, Clem stirs from his slumber. The door slowly opens, and Kay peeks inside. Clem stretches his arms. Wearing a knee-length dress, Kay smiles and strides across the room to open the blackout drapes.
Did I hear you offer me some breakfast?
10 hours ago.
10 hours?
But Vin ate it.
Vin, home.
Home. Both of you.
She leans down and kisses him. then strokes his whiskers.
Oh, where is he now?
He went up to Belden Hall to break the news of the engagement.
Oh, I don't envy him that trip. Serves him right, though, for eating my breakfast. Anything left?
What do you want?
Well, I should... What have you got?
I'll find out.
She goes to the door.
Ada! I didn't know when you were going to wake up, so I couldn't order anything for tea or dinner or
breakfast,
whatever it is.
Of course, no matter what time it is, when I wake up, it's breakfast.
Come in.
Hello, Ada.
Well, I am glad to see you, sir.
Thank you.
After what it said in the papers, I was quite worried about you. Really, I was.
Well, that's very nice of you, Ada, but I'm all right, and all I need now is a good large plate of ham and eggs.
All right, sir.
Then it is in the papers.
About Dunkirk?
Yes.
Yes, dear.
Thank heavens. I shan't have to tell you about it.
Clem, I'm so proud of you.
Are you, darling? Well, that's nice. And come to think of it, I'm a bit proud of myself. What you might call a real bit of navigation. I wouldn't have missed it for the world.
Kay takes his hand.
Oh, darling, I'm almost sorry for you, having such a nice, quiet, peaceful time when things were really happening. But that's what men are for, isn't it? To go out and do things while you women folk look after the house.
Yes, dear. Come in.
I'm sorry, Mum, but I just remembered we ain't got any ham.
What?
He'd give it all to that German pilot.
Oh, well, never mind, Ada. We've got some bacon in the house. Mr. Miniver likes that just as well.
All right, Mum.
What's all that about a German pilot?
Oh, nothing, dear. Nothing at all.
What do you mean, nothing at all?
Well, I just had a German pilot in for ham and eggs this morning, that's all.
What? Wait, say, what's going on here?
Now, Clem, don't get excited. I'm just going to draw your bath.
I've had a bath and I'm not excited.
Will you have a cigarette?
No, I don't want a cigarette. Was it the fellow we were looking for?
Yes.
But what did you do? A woman, you're driving me crazy. Didn't he have a gun?
Yeah, he had a gun.
Well?
Kay lights a cigarette.
I just took it away from him and called the police.
Oh, you just took it to the police and... Oh, just like that.
She puts the cigarette in her husband's mouth.
And then I suppose you gave him tea.
Milk.
Hands on his hips, Clem looks at the floor, then sullenly turns away. Kay tries to stifle a grin as she straightens the bed. Clem turns back and spanks Kay with his slipper.
Milk.
Oh, Clem!
Ada comes in.
Oh.
Come in, that's all.
What is it, Ada? It's the old lady, Mum. And me with the eggs on the stove. It's Lady Belden.
Lady Belden here?
No, Mum, downstairs.
Well, all right, Ada. Tell her I'll be down in just a minute.
Oh, very well, Mum.
Ada leaves.
Lady Belden.
You know, darling, if I hadn't known that you'd taken that German pilot single-handed, I'd say you were scared.
Well, I am scared, just as I was when I took that German pilot single-handed. You know why she's come in such hot haste, don't you?
You object to the marriage, I suppose.
Really, it's insufferable snobbery. With a boy like Vin, she ought to be proud and happy.
And honored.
Wish I had a better dress on. Oh, well. Clement Miniver, don't you dare smile.
Clem's cocky grin follows her out. Kay pauses on the upstairs landing and sees Lady Belden in the sitting room downstairs. Leaning on her cane, the gentlewoman waits with a dour frown. Kay comes downstairs.
Why, Lady Belden, this is nice. Won't you sit down here?
Kay offers a sofa, but Lady Belden seats herself in a chair.
I think I can guess why you came. Vin's told you his news, hasn't he?
Yes, Mrs. Miniver.
Oh, I do hope you're as pleased as we are.
I'm afraid not. Why, they're infants. Carol's 18 and that boy's not 20.
Yes, they are young. But...
I think I should tell you frankly. I hope to persuade Carol to wait.
You think she may change her mind?
Frankly, yes.
Perhaps make a better match.
There's always that possibility.
Well, of course, it may be just maternal vanity, but I don't think Carol will find anyone nicer than Vin. And I don't believe she'll change her mind.
That's a matter of opinion. Her age is a matter of fact.
But isn't that rather a Belden tradition? To marry young?
I don't know what you mean.
My daughter Judy... I don't give me Judy. She had to write a composition on the Crusades last week, and she brought a book home from the library, quite a small book, called A Friend of King Richard the Lionhearted. And it was a life of an ancestor of yours.
Oh, really, Mrs. Miniver, I fail to see
it what... It was a fascinating little book. I got quite interested in it myself. It was full of stories of the Belden family.
Huh? I trust you satisfied yourself that we were worthy of the alliance.
Well, there were one or two things that rather surprised me. For instance, did you know that the 12th Lord Belden was hanged?
He was beheaded. Oh. Such things happen in the best families. In fact, usually in the best families.
As a matter of fact, what interested me most was the extreme youth of the Belden brides. This Gilbert de Beldon, who went on the Crusades, married an Isabel of something or other, aged 12.
Mrs. Miniver, I did not come here to chatter pedigrees. I'm old-fashioned, I believe in breeding. But that's neither here nor there.
Your point is that they're both too young.
I've said so, haven't I?
We're at war, Lady Belden. And Finn's a flyer.
That's no excuse for rushing into an ill-considered marriage.
But in war, time's so precious to the young people. How old were you when you married?
I?
It's no use telling fibs because I looked you up.
Oh, well, if you've looked me up, I suppose you know that I was 16.
16. And did your parents approve?
That's beside the point.
Oh, forgive me, is it? You married very young and without your parents' consent, and yet when Carol... Oh, but perhaps you regretted it.
I did nothing of the kind.
Well, then, why...
My marriage only lasted a few weeks. My husband was in the army. He was killed in action.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Forgive me. I didn't know.
I never regretted it. Not for one moment. We married because we knew that might happen. But I don't want Carol to suffer as I suffered.
Don't you want her to be happy, even for a little while, the way you were?
I was afraid you'd say that. Not that it matters what you say, or what I say either. You know that, don't you?
You mean Carol will go her own way?
She's my granddaughter.
Well, then why?
Goodness knows. I was beaten before I started.
You don't mind terribly, do you? He is a nice boy.
Yes. I see now where he gets it. You're pretty, too. No wonder that wretched Ballard named his rose after you. Not that he's got a chance of getting the cup from me. Well, so long as we're going to be relatives, the least you can do is to offer me some tea.
Kay gazes happily at her guest.
Well?
Oh, yes, yes, of course.
Kay hurries out. Later, in the family's cramped bomb shelter, Kay reads to the kids.
So Alice sat on with closed eyes and half believed herself again in Wonderland, with the grass rustling in the wind and the pool rippling to the waving of the reeds, the tinkling sheep bells, the voice of the shepherd boy, and the lowing of the cattle in the distance. She pictured to herself how she would keep through all her riper years the simple and loving heart of her childhood.
Next year, Clem clenches a pipe in his teeth as he reads.
And make their eyes bright and eager with many a strange tale. Perhaps even with a dream of wonderland.
Toby and Judy lie still in their bed.
They're asleep.
Good.
The cat sits at Toby's feet. Judy sleeps with a doll.
What time is it, darling?
10 to 10.
We see monogrammed luggage bags on a high shelf.
Going to have your coffee now?
No, I think I'll have a little smoke first. Anything you want from the house?
No, I don't think so.
I'm not going to risk my life for your knitting needles again.
No, I've got them with me.
Clem strikes a match against the corrugated metal roof. As he lights his pipe, Kay settles herself in another seat away from the shelter door. Clem turns off the lamp and steps outside. The shelter sits in the yard under layers of sandbags. The nearby house gleams in the moonlight. Clem folds up his blazer's collar against the cold and leans on a sandbag wall to smoke. Holding his pipe upside down in his teeth, he gazes into the night. In the distance, searchlight beams and flashes of gunfire fill the cloudy sky. His wife joins him as he watches.
Fine barrage tonight, isn't it? Gets better each time.
Kay soberly holds her scarf at her throat.
I can't hear any bombs, can you?
No. Suppose they're saving them for the aerodrome again.
the county hospital.
Kay hugs herself in the chill.
Well?
The two of them glance back at their darkened house. Clem empties his pipe.
My laundry come back?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Clem follows Kay inside, backward.
Oh, no, you don't.
Kay brandishes a knitting needle with a grin. Her husband closes the shelter door and relights the lamp. He switches on an exhaust fan in the roof.
You ought to patent that, Clem.
Well, it saves us from suffocating.
He adds a filter.
See this new idea?
No, isn't it?
That's the latest thing in gas detectors. If there's any gas about, this gauze turns green.
Does it stop the gas from coming in?
If you see this gauze change color, grab this.
He swings a lid over it.
Like that, see?
Then what happens?
Then we suffocate.
Oh. Kay pours him a cup of coffee from a thermos.
Biscuit?
Ah, oh, thank you. This is Minerva's best.
Mm-hmm. Ada wasn't much good at coffee.
She was awful. Still, she's a good cook as good cooks go.
And as good cooks go, she went. Still, Ada'll be a tower of strength in the Tancor canteen.
Kay sips coffee and calmly picks up her knitting. Her eyes dart nervously.
Closer.
Clem eyes the cat on the children's bed.
I wonder what Toby'd do if he lost that cat.
I don't think. I suppose that's the way to be really happy. Be with something that you just can't live without.
Yeah.
Or someone.
She rests a gentle hand on her husband's. Clem kisses it, still chewing. Their smiles fade. While Toby sleeps, he holds his cat's tail in his hand. Kay unwinds yarn and continues knitting a scarf.
Isn't that getting a little long, darling?
Well, Finn says they like the long in the Air Force. Isn't it nice that they're getting back in time for the flower show tomorrow?
Yes, isn't it?
Did you find out what time the train arrives?
11:45, I think they said.
Good. I am glad they went to Scotland for the honeymoon after all. So beautiful.
Yeah.
Kay's hands freeze. She and Clem jump. Their daughter, Judy, tosses her head in her sleep. Kay keeps knitting. Clem puts down his cup.
It's a bomb.
I'll go in for the aerodrome again.
Clem picks up Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Have you finished with this, darling?
Yes.
It's a lovely story. Uh-huh. I wonder if Lewis Carroll ever dreamed it would live forever. You know, it's the first story I ever read.
Mine too.
Really?
Huh? Clem pauses on one page.
How she would keep through all her riper years the simple and loving heart of her childhood.
The sleeping Toby pulls his cat's tail closer. The cat blinks calmly.
And how she would gather about her other little children. Make their eyes bright and eager with many a strange tale.
Clem's tense gaze lifts.
Perhaps even with the dream of Wonderland of long ago. And how she would feel with all her simple sorrows and find a pleasure in all her simple joys, remembering her own child life and the happy summer days.
The happy summer days.
He closes the book and puts it down. Kay continues knitting. While Toby tosses in his sleep, his cat calmly licks its paw. At the other end of the small bed, Judy twitches. Kay gazes with concern at the children. Then her features harden, and she takes a deep breath. Clem tensely glances up at the metal roof. The shelter jolts. Food tins fall off the shelf. Clem leans close to Toby, still asleep under his father's protecting arms. The shelter rocks violently. The cat jumps off the bed. The children wake up. Clem and Kay lean over them, shielding them. Clem shushes Toby and strokes his hair. The shelter door swings open, silhouetting Clem against a moonlit dust cloud that swirls around the sandbags outside. Kay picks up Judy and hands her to Clem. Then she picks up little Toby, who's grimacing in terror. Clem gets the door shut and comforts Judy with his embrace. The lamplight falters, putting the family in darkness.
Napoleon's all right, darling. He's gone under there.
Kay and Clem huddle together, clutching their children as the darkened shelter quakes around them. Kay swallows tightly, her frightened gaze darting. Young Judy buries her head in her father's shoulder. Clem reaches over and pushes the door open a bit. Wisps of smoke seep in. Toby looks up at his mother.
Mommy?
Yes, dear?
They nearly killed us this time, didn't they?
It's all over, darling. It's all over now.
Clem opens the door wider and peers out into the swirling smoke. Daytime. At a train station, a passenger locomotive arrives. On the platform, Lady Belden accompanies Kay and Clem. In one coach, Vin leans out the window in full uniform. Carol sits at his side.
Hello, Mother. Hello, Dad.
Hello, darling.
Hello, Lady Belden. How have you been?
Oh, they look well.
Oh, we had a wonderful time.
That's the looking bride you've got, boy.
The newlyweds step out of their compartment into their family's embraces.
Good to see you again. Wonderful.
Oh, Dad, oh, sweet.
Don't I get a kiss?
Certainly do.
Oh, pretty cow.
Did you enjoy yourself?
Oh, we had a lovely time.
Fine. We fished and rowed and sailed.
We had the loveliest little cottage and a Mrs. McLaury to cook for us.
How she cooked and how we ate.
They step off the platform past Mr. Ballard.
Hello, Mr. Ballard.
How do you do, Mr. Vincent? And Miss Carroll.
Morning, Della.
Morning, milady.
I see you have into that rose of yours at the flower show.
It's a good rose, milady.
I haven't seen it yet. I wager the best thing about it is its name.
Mrs. Miniver.
That's you, my dear.
You're coming to the flower show, of course.
All except Clem.
Oh?
I'm afraid I can't, Lady Belden. I'm on patrol duty.
Well, you're missing a lot. Local talent. Old Snoop is playing his flute solo.
I'll be there early.
All right, goodbye, dear.
Careful.
Later, the Minivers return home. One end of the house is in a shambles. A man clears some of the rubble.
How's it going, George?
Fine, Mr. Miniver, just fine.
Let's go, Vin.
Kay leads them inside, pushing open the warped front door.
Well, here we are.
Welcome home, such as it is.
Vin looks around.
Quite a mess.
Must have been dreadful.
Oh, it's not as bad as it looks. We just didn't have time to clear it all up.
The dining room there got the worst of it, but I always didn't want to do that room over.
The upstairs is quite all right.
Yeah. Darling, we'll have to get some blankets up there and black that place out.
Yes.
Everyone turns to look. In the half-ruined library, Judy plays piano while Toby conducts.
Toby, old boy!
Vin gives his little brother a hug.
Hello, Toby.
He hugs Judy.
Oh, Judy, darling, that was wonderful.
Carol, I've
yes,
had
it was fine.
I've had the mumps.
Toby puffs out his cheeks.
Oh, this was a lovely surprise.
All right, children, let Carol go now. Come on, Vin. I'll take you up to your room.
It's your old room, of course, Vin, but we've made a few changes.
Yeah, the Jerry's made a few more.
Kay leads the newlyweds upstairs. Clem stands with his children in the dining room doorway, gazing at the collapsed ceiling and rubble-covered floor. Upstairs.
Thank your father, too, darling. He had a happy
day. I'll do that right away and bring up the rest of the luggage.
Carol gazes around the room, then takes Kay's hands.
Thanks for the lovely room. And thanks for Vin. He is nice, isn't he? Oh, I wonder if you know how much I love him.
I only have to look at you. And him. Have you seen the view here?
Oh, it's really beautiful. Oh, it is.
You're happy?
Of course. I've
had a lifetime of happiness in these last 2 weeks.
But, Carol, that's only the beginning.
Kay, I'm not afraid to face the truth. Are you?
No.
I love him, but I know... I know that I may lose him. He's young and he loves life, but he may die. Let me say it. He may be killed. Any day, any hour. Oh, you must have faced that in your mind.
Yes, I faced it.
Then you know that every moment is precious. We mustn't waste time in fear. Okay, you won't hate me for saying this, will you?
No, Carol.
I will be very happy. Every moment that I have him. Every moment. If I must lose him, there'll be time enough for tears. There'll be a lifetime for tears. Well, that's right, isn't it?
Kay draws Carol to her in an embrace. Vin returns with luggage.
Well, that's the lot. All my wife's. Say, have you noticed our crested dressing case? Swank, eh? Have we time to unpack?
Yes, yes, we don't lunch till 1. I promised your grandmother we'd be at the flower show by 3. We mustn't miss the entertainment. The Glee Club has a new number.
After Kay leaves, Carol puts on a smile for her new husband. They hug tenderly. Later, on the grounds of Belden Hall, local ladies drift among tables of flowers in peak bloom, admiring and smelling them.
We look down, daddy, daddy, down, daddy, daddy, down, daddy, daddy, down, and the hey, mommy, mommy, hey, mommy, mommy, hey, mommy, hey.
One mustached gentleman wearing a judge's ribbon inspects a table of small blossomed flowers. Nearby, a bartender pours mugs of beer from a keg. The Glee Club singers sit on a stage in their Sunday best.
Oh, glorious it is on a midsummer's day to fa la 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 to lay.
Dozens of townspeople seated on benches watch the show. In front row chairs, Kay and the vicar sit with Lady Belden, Vin, and Carol.
How glorious it is on a midsummer's day.
Interlude by the Bellum Band.
The Glee Club singers relax. In the audience, Mr. Ballard joins a group of men on a bench near the back.
Hello, Ballard. How are you?
Oh, thanks. Good luck.
Thank you. Best of luck to you.
I hope you get it, Ballard.
Thanks.
Three judges peer at two roses, the white, many-petaled Belden Rose and the Mrs. Miniver, darker with finer petals.
Pickles.
An official joins Lady Belden.
Hurry that paper from the judges on the Rose Award. We want to get through with this.
Judges are still debating, milady.
What? Whatever for? Ridiculous creatures. Go and tell them I want that decision at once.
Yes, milady.
Vin leans forward.
Have you seen old Ballard's Rose?
No, I haven't. That's a lie. I looked it over the moment it arrived.
Well...
good rose.
Is it better than yours?
That young man, the judges will decide.
You should worry, you'll get the cup.
Are you insinuating that judges are corrupt?
I'm insinuating they're scared of you.
Oh, scared.
The elder Pickles returns.
The decision on the Rose Award, milady.
He hands Lady Belden a note. As Kay looks on, the solemn-faced lady peers at it through her reading glasses. The note reads, "First prize, Lady Belden. Second prize, James Ballard." She smiles.
Well, Mr. Vincent Miniver, take a look at that.
Congratulations. Well, I'm not a bit surprised.
Set yourself up to know more than the judges, eh? Misguided young man. Can't think what you see in him, Carol.
Kay smiles.
This is really important to you, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Stupid of me, but there it is. I won that cup for as long as I can remember.
Mr. Ballard's terribly keen, too.
Well, he's had his chance. Hasn't he?
Kay's steady, bright gaze falls on Lady Belden, who grimaces.
You've such a way of looking at people. What do you expect me to do about it? Reverse the judge's decision?
I wouldn't put it past you. If you happen to disagree with it.
But I don't.
Pickles returns.
Your ladyship make the award now. Certainly.
Lady Belden stands, along with the vicar and Vin in his crisp dress uniform. The vicar escorts the elderly hostess to the stage. She turns to the judges.
Miss Rose Award, it's your unprejudiced decision.
Why? Certainly, my ladies.
Of course, my ladies.
Won't you sit down? Sit down.
She motions the audience to sit.
My friends of Belem, it is once again my pleasure to present the annual awards for the best flowers grown in our community.
She reads a list.
The first prize, chrysanthemums. First prize, Miss Alice Lundeen.
A lady in a wide-brimmed, fashionably tilted hat hurries up the steps to the stage, where she shakes Lady Belden's hand and receives a trophy cup. A dozen other trophies sit in a group on the stage.
Second prize, Miss Sarah Pilbury.
Later, only the largest trophy stands unawarded. Lady Belden holds the note.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I come to the final award. The Challenge Cup, given for the best rose.
Judges place the two roses on the table in front of her. She glances between them, then to Kay as the audience looks on.
The best rose grown in the village during the past year. The first prize, the silver cup, goes to...
Her gaze falls on the gleaming cup. Then, as Kay watches with shining eyes, she crumples the note.
Goes to Mr. James Ballard, our popular station master.
Mr. Ballard gapes. Kay, Vin, and Carol all grin happily as they clap. Mr. Ballard's benchmate pats him on the shoulder. At the front table, Lady Belden stands erect, gazing regally at the audience. Two men push Mr. Ballard to his feet, but he immediately sits, a mortified expression on his face. Lady Belden holds up her hands.
The second prize, the Certificate of Merit, goes to me.
Vin and others in the audience give her a standing ovation. Lady Belden acknowledges them with a nod, tears shine in her eyes. Swallowing, she holds up her hands for silence.
All right. This is the first time a rose, other than the Belden rose, has won the cup since the shows began. I won't say I'm not disappointed. We Beldens are not used to competitors. In the old days, we just lopped off their heads. Can't do that nowadays.
More's the pity.
But if I had to lose, there's no man I'd sooner lose to than James Ballard. Because he's a man of spirit, and I like a man of spirit. Where are you? Ballard, where's that man?
Mr. Ballard's friends again urge him to stand.
Here he is, Belding! Here he is!
Mr. Ballard finally rises. A man pushes him into the center aisle. Standing there uncertainly in his dapper three-piece suit, he takes off his black fedora hat and grins. Blinking back tears, he starts down the aisle to the stage. Kay beams, watching him. As the station master reaches the front row, Kay rises and takes his hand.
Oh, Mr. Ballard, I'm so happy for you.
It's your rose, ma'am.
She kisses his cheek. He gazes deeply at her with moist eyes. Kay motions to the stage and Mr. Ballard proceeds in a daze. On stage, the helmeted Mr. Foley approaches Lady Belden.
Excuse me, my lady.
Now, Foley.
She offers Ballard the cup.
Well, take it.
Thank you, my lady.
Congratulations.
Pardon my liberty.
They shake hands.
My lady. Enemy planes over the coast. Hundreds of them. Like as not, they'll go after the airfield again.
Mr. Ballard carries his cup down the aisle, past a drunken man and his angry wife.
the harmony of this occasion. But our enemies are no respecters of flower shows. Foley here says there's a chance of air raiders passing this way.
In the circumstances, it might be better if you would return to your homes. Those of you who prefer are welcome to the use of my cellars. It'll be lively. My young visitors will see to that. And you won't starve. Foley's seen to that. I believe we have 300 tins of Italian sardines.
The townspeople rise and quickly file away. Later, in front of the Belden Hall mansion, automobiles drive off. Some folks ride bicycles. Vin opens the Miniver car's door for his mother and Carol.
Granny,
will
it be all right?
Of course. You're not leaving me alone, you know.
You were wonderful, darling. They loved you for it. Vin feels you'll get back to the airport.
Yes, 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 of course.
Lady Belden passes Vin.
Give him a glass for me, will you?
I shall certainly try.
He gets into the car.
Wait. I still like to be kissed, you know.
Vin kisses her cheek.
I say, you were wonderful.
Yes, I was wonderful.
Goodbye.
Vin drives them away. The vicar and Lady Belden gaze after them. Lady Belden glances tensely at her companion. The vicar takes her arm and escorts her to the brick mansion's arched front door. More than a dozen townsfolk join them. Later, the Miniver's sporty convertible speeds along a wooded lane, passing soldiers hunkered down beside a skyward-pointing searchlight. At an airbase, young pilots sprint across a dusty road toward the airfield. More pilots, wearing jumpsuits and goggles, pour out of a barracks with several uniformed officers. Now Vin drives up. A pilot hurries over.
Jerry's over London in hundreds. Looks like a big show.
So I'll have to run. Goodbye, darling.
Vin kisses Carol and his mother, then gets out.
Vin.
The two women watch him go.
He'll be all right, Carol.
Kay manages an uncertain smile. Carol's tight gaze lingers on the hectic activity around them. A squadron of Spitfire warplanes takes off. With tapered, low-mounted wings, they each have a single propeller and an RAF bullseye insignia on their fuselages. As the planes soar away, Kay and Carol watch from the car.
You must get on, Carol. Now just get back to the children.
Kay slides to her right into the driver's seat and steers the car away past a group of airmen in jumpsuits. Later, after dusk, the car crawls along the wooded country lane with the headlights off. Kay cranes forward nervously as she drives, gripping the steering wheel in her gloved hands. Ahead, moonlight stripes the dirt lane.
Do you think the little Foley girl will have the sense to take the children into the shelter?
Of course, don't worry, Kay.
Carol squints tensely ahead. Kay shudders. Her brow knit and her shoulders hunched, Kay takes shallow breaths.
They seem to be fighting right over our heads. I want so much to get home. I hate to stop, but because I'd better.
Kay brings the car to a stop in the road. She sits back. Her jaw clenches. Her thin nostrils flare. Chest heaving, she gazes out into the night. Beside her, Carol leans close, her delicate young features tight. Kay sits still, her eyes wide. She blinks. Carol winces. Kay looks out the window and gasps. A plane with both engines on fire heads straight for them. It passes just above their car and wings a tree. Explosions rip through the plane as it skids to a stop in a cloud of dust and flames. In the car, Kay and Carol sit up and stare in horror at the wreckage. The flames tower high above the trees. Carol's lips tremble. Kay grips her shoulders.
Could be, Vin. It could! No, Carol, no, it's not possible. There hasn't been time. How horrible.
Kay shoves Carol down. Two planes cross paths overhead. Explosions riddle the ground. Kay opens her eyes.
Those were bullets. I was sure they hit the car. I really was frightened.
She looks out the window.
Oh, Carol. The village.
Distant fires light the horizon.
Oh, we must get back there. They need help. Carol. Carol, what is it?
Carol slumps,
Carol.
Her eyes closed.
Carol, are you hurt?
She opens her eyes a bit. Kay sees blood on her neck.
Darling.
Looking up at the car roof, Kay sees a line of bullet holes in the fabric. She gazes down at her daughter-in-law.
Carol. I think I've been hit. Oh, no, darling. Where?
I don't know. It doesn't hurt. I just can't.
Kay gently cups Carol's calm, upturned face.
Don't be frightened. We're nearly home. I'll get you in and I'll get help. I'll lie still.
Yes, Kay.
A faint smile touches Carol's lips. Later, at home, Kay uses the phone.
Emergency.
Her hand trembles, but she forces a smile to Carol, who lies on her back on the floor, her eyes glassy. Kay's smile fades.
Emergency? Ambulance, at once. All out? But this is terribly urgent. So is this an air raid casualty? It's terribly... Well, the moment you get one in, the first possible moment, send it to Stardings. No, Stardings. Yes, the last house in Norton Lane. Yes, and hurry, please, hurry.
She hangs up and kneels over Carol.
They're coming as soon as they can. Get a coat, darling.
Carol lies still, her chest gently rising as she breathes. Kay brings a coat and drapes it over Carol. She leans over the pretty young woman.
You'll be here any moment now.
You won't tell Vin?
Of course not, darling. Darling.
Kay presses her lips to Carol's cheek in a soft kiss.
You're going to be all right, Carol. I know you are. Don't be frightened, sweet.
Oh, I'm going to be all right. Feel any pain?
What is it? Can I get you something?
Glass of water.
Of course, darling. Right back.
Kay sits up, reluctant to take her eyes from Carol. Finally standing, she hurries away. Carol's head lolls to the side. Kay returns and kneels over the still young woman.
Carol! Carol! Carol!
Desperately, she hugs Carol to her chest.
Oh, God! God! God!
In the stark moonlight, she rocks gently. Tears glisten in the corners of her eyes. She stares down at the limp young woman in her arms. Her face contorts in anguish, and she hugs Carol tighter. Later, in the upstairs hallway, a sliver of daylight silhouettes Clem's shadow on the wall as he comes out of a bedroom. Closing the door behind him, he descends the stairs. His hunched shadow follows along the wall. Downstairs, thick darkness envelops him. Kay's there in the shadows, sitting in a chair, stiffly unmoving. Her husband unpins a black sheet from a window. Sunlight slants across the floor, brightening the room. Glancing out the window, Clem strokes his chin, then comes to stand by his wife at the base of the stairs. Her gaze remains numbly downcast, her hands folded in her lap. She blinks and looks to the door a few feet away. Standing, she steps to her husband's side and faces the door. Her clasped hands fidget. Clem rests his hand at her elbow. Together, they wait. The door opens. It's Vin.
Vin, dear.
Kay approaches him, her gaze searching his grim face.
It's all right, Mother. I know. Where is she?
Vin, dear, won't you try and get a little rest?
Where is she?
In your room.
Vin walks past her to the stairs. His father and mother gaze after him as he climbs, his steps heavy and slow. On the upstairs landing, he turns the corner to his bedroom. Sunlight silhouettes him on the wall as he opens the door and steps inside. Kay bursts into tears and buries her head on Clem's shoulder. He holds her in a strong embrace. Later, at church, the somber Kay arrives dressed in black with Vin, the children, and her husband. As they find a pew, more villagers arrive. One man walks with crutches and wears a head bandage. Lady Belden walks down the aisle, followed by her chauffeur. The elder, grim-faced lady wears a black cloak over her dress. As the chauffeur helps her to her pew box, the choir enters. Lady Belden bows her head as the congregation rises. Kay stands between her husband and son. Vin, wearing his crisp dress uniform, gazes somberly at Lady Belden. Lady Belden rises with her hymnal. Along the nave, stout wooden beams support the stone arches. Sandbags and debris litter the outer aisle. The choir and vicar take their places at the front.
Jesus Christ, your Father's Son, bids you on this day go on. Amen.
The congregation sits. At the head of the church, the vicar steps onto a makeshift wooden podium. Behind him, the end wall of the church lies in ruins, with trees and sky in the distance.
I will read to you from Psalm number 91. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress. My God, in Him will I trust. Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler.
The vicar closes his Bible. His lean features grim, he looks out over his congregation.
We in this quiet corner of England have suffered the loss of friends very dear to us. Some close to this church. George West, choir boy.
One choir seat is empty.
James Ballard, station master and bell ringer, and the proud winner, only an hour before his death, of the Belden Cup for his beautiful Minerva Rose.
Lady Belden's eyes shine with tears.
And our hearts go out in sympathy for the two families who share the cruel loss of a young girl who was married at this altar only 2 weeks ago. The homes of many of us have been destroyed, and the lives of young and old have been taken. There's scarcely a household that hasn't been struck to the heart. And why? Surely you must have asked yourselves this question. Why, in all conscience, should these be the ones to suffer? Children. Old people. A young girl at the height of her loveliness. Why these? Are these our soldiers? Are these our fighters? Why should they be sacrificed? I shall tell you why. Because this is not only a war of soldiers in uniform. It is a war of the people, of all the people. And it must be fought not only on the battlefield, but in the cities and in the villages, in the factories and on the farms, in the home and in the heart of every man, woman, and child who loves freedom. Well, we have buried our dead, but we shall not forget them. Instead, they will inspire us with an unbreakable determination to free ourselves and those who come after us from the tyranny and terror that threaten to strike us down. This is the people's war. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Vin's shining, determined gaze drifts to an opposite pew. He rises with the rest of the congregation and slips past his family to stand with Lady Belden. They share her hymnal. Kay slips her arm through her husband's and rests her hand on little Toby's shoulder. Tears glimmer in her eyes as she joins the hymn. Formations of warplanes overhead, V-shaped groups of five soaring across the bright, cloudy sky. Fade to black. Credits appear. Cast: Greer Garson as Mrs. Miniver, Walter Pidgeon as Clem Miniver, Teresa Wright as Carol Belden, Dame Mae Whitty as Lady Belden, Reginald Owen as Foley, Henry Travers as Mr. Ballard, Richard Nye as Vin Miniver, Henry Wilcoxon as vicar. Over a long-stemmed rose with a royal coat of arms, words appear. The end. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. America needs your money. Buy defense bonds and stamps every payday.